Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
One of the best parts about working at the Hudson Institute is there's this vast wealth of knowledge about global affairs and how different geopolitical situations are playing out across the world. So this week, we're continuing the Realignment's coverage of the coronavirus outbreak. We've got Hudson Senior Fellows Michael Duran covering the Middle East, Peter Rao covering Europe, and John Lee focused on the Asia-Pacific region. So we're going to continue on with that and seeing how the coronavirus is continuing and accelerating previous trends the world was experiencing. And then just a quick note, if it sounds like all of us were in different rooms and possibly different continents, that's 100% correct. We are continuing our remote recording of this episode. We hope you guys enjoy it and we're going to keep at it.
And with that, let's dive in. Mike Duran, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Mike, so let's talk a little bit about coronavirus in Iran. Iran has been probably one of the most stricken countries by the virus and also one of the most opaque in terms of its reporting. You've been out there highlighting what's been happening to the regime, which has just been waylaid by this. What are some of the developments out of that country geopolitically as a result of this crisis?
Well, it's actually one of the hardest hit countries. According to the official numbers, I think it's the fourth or fifth heaviest hit, but it's probably much worse than that because the official statistics are absolutely unreliable. The regime has been dishonest about it from the beginning, dishonest with its own people and dishonest with the rest of the world. It broke out in Qom, which is the religious capital of the country, and it's the ideological font of the regime. This is where all the seminaries are. It's a holy city, and so there was a kind of double desire, one political and one sort of ideological religious, not to admit that there was an outbreak there. The political one was that it broke out just before the elections in February, and the regime, which is in the midst of a legitimacy crisis in any case, didn't want to start restricting movements on people when they were fearful that the election turnout was going to be at an all-time low because nobody believes in the election system. And so they withheld the information from a political point of view to get people to go to the polls. Which didn't work, by the way. But then the clerics in Qom themselves didn't want to admit that there was an outbreak because they thought it would delegitimate their own institutions, but also harm their livelihood because the city depends on a lot of religious tourism and seminarians who come to study there and so forth. So it's a kind of a multifaceted legitimacy crisis for the regime.
And something I've been wondering is, why did Iran break out so early? Obviously, with Italy, you had the connections to Chinese manufacturing industries. What happened in Iran that led the initial breakout?
Well, it's exactly the Chinese connection. It's the same thing. There are Qom has two strong connections to China. One is it has hundreds of Chinese seminarians. These are Chinese Shiites who are studying in Qom. And one set of beliefs is that they brought the virus in. And another set of beliefs is that the Chinese workers who are working in oil fields and other related construction sites around Qom brought in the disease. And this connection to China is another aspect of the crisis for the Iranians, because in their effort to restructure their economy to handle the American sanctions, they have increased their ties to China, and their economic ties to China in particular are absolutely crucial to them. And so they didn't want to shut down that as well. And in fact, the flights between Iran and China have continued throughout. And that's become a big source of frustration among the populace in Iran who are angry that these flights have never been closed down.
And Mike, one of the things that is also happening in the midst of this crisis is not only the coronavirus, but also crude oil prices have been swinging all around, which is, of course, wreaking havoc on their economy. In terms of the political dynamics vis-a-vis the United States, has anything changed in the U.S.-Iran situation? We've seen some reports about some administration officials advocating a more hawkish stance towards the country at this time. Do you think that that would be wise?
I think that personally, I do think it would be wise, but let's hold off on the policy debate for a second and just realize how much this has hurt Iran, how badly Iran is doing. The U.S. sanctions against Iran have devastated the economy because they haven't completely ended oil exports, but they've reduced them tremendously, and the inflation of the rial has destroyed the value of the currency. That was happening in general, but then you had a series of other shocks to Iran. In November you had the, I'm just talking about domestically, this thing's talking about foreign policy. In November you had the wave of protests against the regime, which killed up to 1,500 people, required the regime to shut down the internet for several days in order so that nobody abroad could see what the heavy-handed tactics that they were using to put down the protests. That took an economic toll. And then following the killing of Qasem Soleimani, there was this issue over the downing by the Revolutionary Guards of this airliner that was going to Ukraine. You remember that? That was another shock to the Iranian system, and that's part of the reason why they were so eager to cover up this coronavirus crisis, because they recognize it as the elites are thinking about it first and foremost as a political threat. You know, even Khamenei has suggested that it's actually Khamenei, the supreme leader, has suggested that it's a bioweapon that the United States is using against Iran. It is obviously going to have tremendous economic consequences for the country. I mean, because people don't want Iranian flights to come in for obvious reasons. Tourism has ended. And as I mentioned, that this religious tourism was extremely important to Iran. There's also actually medical tourism to Iran. People from Iraq go to Iran to get medical treatment. They're not going to do that now. This coronavirus crisis is taking an incredible toll on the medical professionals in Iran who are not equipped. They don't have the personal protective equipment. They don't have the knowledge about how to deal with this problem. And one of the stories that will eventually come out, it's already starting to come out on social media, but someday someone will tell the full story of the death toll among doctors and nurses as a result of this.
So, you know, going back to your earlier point about how a crisis is going on during elections, I think that helps a swing the conversation towards Israel, which is sort of at the other end of the region and also area of your focus. How has Israel handled the coronavirus outbreak?
Well, very differently. And the Israelis were on top of this probably earlier than anyone, I think. I shouldn't say that. I don't know if they were on top of it before the North Koreans, the Japanese, and Singapore and Hong Kong. But they were in terms of the European response, the Israelis were on top of it way ahead of time. And they were already predicting. They have a very, very good team of medical professionals at the top of their system, and they were already on top of how this thing was going to expand exponentially. And so you'll remember that the Israelis shut down all flights into the country before anybody else in Europe was even thinking in those terms. And when they did it, everyone thought they were a little bit crazy, but that was because they were. I think they saw it very clearly. Part of the reason, I haven't seen anyone discuss this in Israel, but I suspect that part of the reason they saw it so clearly is they recognized it as a national security threat from the beginning. And they recognized that their entire medical system could become overwhelmed by this, and that and they're set up in terms of their mindset and in terms of their institutions, I think they're set up pretty well to handle these kinds of national security threats. So they moved into sort of total lockdown, similar to where the British are now, before any of the other European countries were thinking that way.
So overall, I think as we look at the broader Middle Eastern region, what do you think, what's your sort of main takeaway from how the region's really navigated the crisis?
Well, I think the biggest takeaway is the damage to the Iranians. Obviously, we discussed the political toll at home and the economic toll. But it's also hurting them in the region because the legitimacy crisis that they're suffering is not just a domestic one. It's also one about their influence in Lebanon, Iraq, and Syria. And in each of those places, particularly in Lebanon and Iraq, we're now seeing a movement of people on the ground who see the connection between those countries and Iran as a tremendous liability to those countries. The export of coronavirus from Iran to those countries is only going to increase that feeling, which is already extremely strong. American sanctions are doing a lot to strengthen that feeling because it's teaching people or allowing people to make the argument that they cannot have a viable economic future as long as their states are closely tied to Iran. And with regard to the rest of the countries in the region, I think it's more a story of, if we're talking about, say, Saudi Arabia, I think it's more a story that the rest of us are going through, the same kind of uncertainty about what this is going to do to our economies and so forth. But not a kind of obvious dramatic change that we see with regard to Iran. In the case of Israel, if we'd had this conversation a week ago, I would have said it was near certain to me that this crisis was going to save Netanyahu, who's under indictment for 3 different charges, and Israel's had 3 elections. And neither of the major parties has been able to put together a government. So there's a political crisis, and then Netanyahu personally has a legal crisis. And it looked to me like he had done such a good job of managing the response to coronavirus that he was going to use it, I think, to overcome some of these difficulties. Today, if you look at this, it's not exactly certain that that's going to be the outcome. I think I would still push that analysis, but the Israelis now have a constitutional crisis that they're working through. I don't think we want to get into all the details of that. I still would bet, though, that we're going to see Netanyahu's leadership strengthened by this crisis. But that's not a certainty by any stretch of the imagination.
Very interesting. Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us with this mini update. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. All right, take care.
And Marshall, something I think that's the most interesting that Mike Duran was talking about there is just how hard hit the Iranian regime has been by this crisis. It's something that we haven't considered as much, but it certainly could go on to impact the future of all of our interactions with that country because it's changed its entire political structure.
Yeah, and I think what's so helpful about the Iranian example is there's a lot of this sort of narrative emerging that democracies, liberal or otherwise, have an inability to cope with this crisis. They can't sort of order their citizens to stay inside. They can't sort of force the sort of compliance easily. And people have sort of started to say that's a strength. But I think the Iranian example, along with the Chinese example, really shows that part of the problem, though, is that these authoritarian regimes are actually quite afraid of confronting issues in the first place. So you see the sort of repression of information that prevents them from actually addressing these conflicts at the start. So I think it's really important to acknowledge that there's a real weakness that's being exposed on the authoritarian side here.
And with that, let's jump into our interview with Hudson Senior Fellow Peter Rao on Europe.
Welcome to our expedited version of The Realignment.
Thanks for having me on.
Good to see you, Peter.
So, Peter, you cover Europe and the Middle East as a senior fellow at Hudson. But for the today's episode, we wanted to bring you in to the continent of Europe specifically. When people think about Europe, they think about sort of three main countries when it comes to the coronavirus. People are talking about Italy. People are thinking about how Germany's responding because of sort of the role that Merkel and the Germans play in the European Union. And then people are also considering what's happening in the United Kingdom in terms of the transatlantic relationship. So what are your broad thoughts on how these differing models of governance are encountering the crisis?
Well, first of all, Europe writ large is facing, as the epicenter of the crisis, a medical emergency layered on top of which is an economic and financial catastrophe. But what's coming next is really a political crisis. And I think that's what's just over the horizon and will hit the continent writ large. Rather than dividing Europe into three countries, I'd divide it more into Northern Europe and Southern Europe, and then maybe set the UK aside as almost sui generis or a case of its own. Italy is facing absolutely horrendous medical problems, especially in Northern Italy, which was the first hit by the crisis. And all of it's interesting for the U.S. because I think for American listeners who aren't all that interested in Europe or who don't spend a lot of time thinking about Europe, everyone is looking at the infection curves. Everyone's looking at even anecdotal evidence coming out of other countries and almost seeing different responses as laboratories of what works, what doesn't, what might befall the U.S. 10 days hence, or what might take place in the U.S. in 14 or 20 days. And thus far, we've seen different responses by both Southern Europe and Northern Europe. The Italians, because they were first hit, really didn't see this coming. The U.S. now at least has the example of Italy, I think, to inject a lot of seriousness into people on the importance of social distancing. And because of the nature of this virus, what we know about it thus far, it isn't always all that easy to detect. So Northern Italy has been absolutely ravaged, and the Italians are just hanging on quite literally for dear life, and their economy is in free-for-all. Northern Europe has done, and the same, by the way, I would add, applies more or less, maybe not quite to the same degree, but it's really just around the corner to Spain. Northern Europe and Germany, which is kind of the big power in Europe, is doing a little bit better. In part, that's because different kind of, I think, testing regimes, potentially because young people were infected at a higher rate who require lower hospitalization than Southern Italy. But what's really interesting about the politics of this is that, Europe is kind of a frail politics. There are peoples across Europe who believe in their own nation states, but the only reason they really are willing to cede power to Brussels and to Europe as in return for prosperity. So the European Union isn't really built for crisis. It's built for prosperity. And so we already see the Italians frustrated by the EU, and that really means Germany, because they're unwilling to share financial liabilities. They're unwilling to shoulder some of the burdens that Italy is facing thus far. And so Germany has not yet been hit at the same levels. That might just be around the corner too. And so we've just seen different levels of a medical emergency, different levels of kind of an economic hit, although that's coming full circle now. And politically, I'd say Northern Europe and Southern Europe are handling this a little bit differently. And then the UK is its own case, I would say, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting, Peter, about just like the three dichotomies that you've laid out there. I guess what my question is on the political dynamics. What does this mean for the European Union? Because one of the things that we're also looking at is that this coronavirus crisis is exposing a lot of the fractures and the fissures in American society and American political system. And I assume that's the case abroad as well. So talk to us about that in the European context.
Well, if in the U.S. there are those who are now saying, look, globalization, interconnected supply chains, all the rest are bigger liabilities than they are benefits. And then others in the U.S. are saying, no, what we need is more cooperation. The reason why this crisis has been so bad is not because globalization, but we haven't been able to feather its blows because we're not cooperating enough. And Europe, I think the divide is between those who are saying the European Union is a half-baked organism and what we need is more European Union, more shared liability, more solidarity. And we've already seen allies of Emmanuel Macron, the French president, call for a more empowered European Union in the European Parliament in the last day or so. There are others who are going to say this just shows why the current state of politics isn't effective. I think there was a new poll out from Italy showing that
the numbers have just dropped precipitously in support that, I mean, for the statement, the European Union is to our advantage, and the statement, the European Union is a disadvantage, has seen numbers shoot up. So they're looking at this and saying there might be a European Central Bank monetary mechanism rolled out, but when it comes to shared liabilities, the fiscal burden, we feel a little bit left on our own. And so, you know, there'll be a real, I think, clash between those who say globalization is bad, globalization is good, more Europe, less Europe, and that's going to intensify in the coming months and years.
Mm-hmm.
So, Peter, you had a piece out at the Eurasia Review where you sort of spoke about how longer term, because that's something we like doing on the podcast. We're obviously focused on the news here, but for someone thinking about what the world is going to look like, hopefully after this crisis, what are the longer term implications for Europe's economy and the way that they have sort of structured their supply chains and their exports and everything like that?
Well, Europe is an export-led economic bloc. It's a little bit like Japan, which after World War II kind of gave up on its militarization in foreign affairs and instead focused on building up its economy and becoming an export superpower. Germany has done the same thing in Europe, and a lot of European countries surrounding it basically act as supply chains into Germany. Germany's exported a lot to the United States over the years, but it's grown more and more addicted on China. The last 3 or 4 years, its biggest trading partner, its biggest export destination has been China. And this really builds, I think, to an incongruence in Germany's thinking or in Europe, because on the one hand, it needs China, it exports to China, it pushes a lot of its product there. On the other hand, the Chinese are busily at work, I think, undermining European politics. We already see this propaganda campaign at work in the United States, blaming the US for the coronavirus. In Europe, they are very cleverly and tactically shipping masks to some of their hoped-for partners, be it the Italians, who are the biggest European part of the Belt and Road Initiative. They've sent masks to Greece, where they already have bought up quite a bit of infrastructure. The Chinese have this thing called the 17+1 format, where it takes 17 European countries. Some are EU members, some are aspirants to the European Union, some are just in Europe. And it tries to build kind of a separate discussion and diplomatic format for them, which clearly is a rival, or would like to see as a competitor even to the EU. So I suppose we'll see the idea of Europe take a bit of a blow, the Chinese and Russian meddling increase, and the economies are going to be totally and completely devastated. No, what people forget is Italy hasn't grown since 1999 or 2000, since it joined the euro. So it already had a base skepticism about the benefits of European Union, because the traditional mechanism like devaluing your currencies weren't available to it. Now, that's only going to be reinforced by this crisis.
And Peter, when we think about Europe writ large, and you're like you're saying, there's a fracturing in the political system and the economic system, and just it's kind of confirmed biases for a lot of different people. What are some of the lessons maybe that we can learn from the United States on some of the, what are some of the good lessons that we can learn from Europe in their handling of this crisis as we ourselves bear down in with the coronavirus?
I think there's a big health lesson, in part because Europe is an advanced first world economic and political system. And so if Spain isn't able to cope with the coronavirus, if Italy is being overwhelmed, if the Northern European states are turning in that direction, then I think we can look to Europe and say, what have they done right? What have they done wrong? And how can we move quickly to either overcome those mistakes or reinforce those successes? So as I think most people are aware at this point, the UK at first rolled out a slightly different strategy for combating the coronavirus and has since pivoted, as it turns out not to have worked. The Germans now are trying to limit gatherings to 2 or 3 people. Italy's locked down altogether. And based upon how I think rates respond to this, I think the US will be able to take some health lessons. And then on the economic front, you know, usually these sorts of huge central bank actions involve some coordination. I imagine, given the level of transatlantic trade and how interwoven our economies are, that there'll be some coordination there and working together like there was after the financial crisis in 08, 09. And then politically, I think it's just going to reinforce the battle between those who say we need more global and those who say we need more national competencies.
Yeah, and that's really interesting to finish up, because I think it's not as if the coronavirus, from what I'm taking from your comment, is going to fundamentally change everything in the case of Europe. It's just going to push on the fissures that already existed there before and further emphasize some of those divides.
If in the US, the lesson for, say, Peter Navarro is that we need to repatriate supply chains and build our medical stocks back home, but the lesson for his opponents are, no, this is really just a question of coordination. So we need supply chains that are longer. We need supply chains that have bigger inventories. In Europe, this isn't changing people's views. It's just reinforcing that which people already think. So the Federalists are saying, well, look, the problem is we don't have enough of a federal state. Whereas the Nationalists are saying, look, Europe's incompetent and incapable. We need to really have a pure nation state. And the EU as a half-baked kind of organism is stuck in between.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining, and we'll be sure to hear more from you on this incredibly important topic.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks for having me. Thanks.
I thought that was a really great point that Peter made about how we can observe and look at what happened in Europe, Marshall, between Northern and Southern Europe. Because obviously all eyes here in the United States on Italy, there's all these different discussions about, are we in Italy? Are we 10 days behind Italy? But looking at by kind of the natural experiment that's playing out across so many political systems that are similar to ours, I think there are actually quite a few lessons to be had there, and especially the intra-political fight over the European Union, whether to double down on it or whether to draw away, very much mirrors our own politics here at home.
Yeah, and I actually liked his longer-term point about how the European Union just wasn't made to weather crises. It was sort of premised on this sort of notion that we'd have that post-Cold War perpetual peace. So as soon as you had issues like the 2008 financial crisis, or now the 2020 coronavirus crisis, you've just seen it not really be able to strengthen and work as an institution. So I think that really lends itself to a broader discussion about how the institutions we set up are really sort of capable of weathering crises, because that's the one thing I think we could guarantee on the international level.
Certainly. And I mean, this is something that we're about to go into with Dr. John Lee. He's a Hudson Fellow who looks at this, the Asia Pacific. He's based out of Australia. And part of our discussion with him is really about how this has shocked geopolitics in the very same way, vis-a-vis the Asia Pacific's relationship with China, and how they very much are looking at the Chinese with a much more distrustful eye, thinking about disentangling business relationships and more with them. And the coronavirus crisis, I think, I've been saying this now for a long time, has really exposed the geopolitical order for what it is. It's making policymakers having to take difficult choices about some of the things they've maybe have been able to justify in the past.
Yeah, and this goes back to the interview last week of Tim Morrison, where he was talking about how the U.S. is now reconsidering the way we've set up our supply chains. What Dr. Lee talks about is that's the same conversation that's happening in Asia right now. And that's just a really important thing to really recognize, that these economic relationships we forge have costs. And it's not just purely this sort of win-win situation that a lot of people, and especially the Chinese, were promoting. So that's a really good segue into all that.
Absolutely. So with that, let's take a listen.
John Lee, welcome to The Realignment.
Great to be here.
So we've been covering the coronavirus's geopolitical impact across the world stage. At Hudson, your work focuses on the Asia Pacific. You're based out of Australia. How should we look at the impact of the coronavirus on the Asia-Pacific region? I know that's incredibly broad, but I think given that the sort of crisis originated there, it's sort of a great place to start.
The economic impacts are obvious. You've seen a huge economic impact in China, probably around a 3% fall in GDP for the most recent quarter, and that's just China. The rest of Asia is really starting to feel the pandemic now. China's been a couple of months ahead of us in terms of pain. But the geopolitical impact, or at least the economic impacts and geopolitical consequences, may be more profound. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, China was widely seen as a bit of a bully, or very much of a bully, but it provided economic opportunity. The conversation has changed in Asia Pacific quite significantly. Yes, China will still be a very significant economy, but beyond being able to build bridges really quickly, beyond being able to build roads and ports really quickly, The question now is, are China's institutions fit for purpose? Do we want to make long-term bets on the Chinese institutional and governance model, or should we look elsewhere? And for the first time, really, since I've been following this region, so more than a decade, there's quite a burgeoning but powerful conversation on diversifying away from China. So China won't become irrelevant. They're not going to abandon China, but there's a real conversation from business communities, not just strategic people, about diversifying away from China and seeing the Chinese model as a risk and not a virtue, which was previously the case.
That's interesting, Dr. Lee. It kind of mirrors a domestic political conversation we're having here in the United States about supply chains, dependency on China. What is it exactly about the Chinese regime's response to this crisis which has spawned that conversation in the Asia-Pacific region?
There's palpable anger that China knew about not just the strain of coronavirus, but how contagious and deadly it could be. But suppress that information, first of all, from its own population, and then secondly, from the world. So to give you a timeline, which is now widely reported, by around mid-December, China knew exactly what they were dealing with in terms of the virus itself. They didn't quarantine people in Wuhan until mid-January sometime, but there were a few days where the Chinese government allowed Chinese people to travel both within China and also outside China. So in that period of time, millions of people travel within China and considerable numbers of people went outside China and spread it around the world, including in Asia. I think there's now palpable anger, and it's not just anger, there's an understanding that it's the governance arrangements or failures of governance in China given its authoritarian setup that actually led to the situation. And of course, that's now had economic consequences, and that's what's been really driving the conversation.
There's an emerging narrative that Western democracies have sort of failed to handle and manage the process. You're seeing struggles in Italy, you're seeing struggles in Spain, obviously the United States is struggling. How is Australia faring when it comes to the coronavirus?
Australia, even though it's a large country by geography, we have smaller populations. So in a sense, it's easy for us to handle the spread of it compared to the United States, for example. So Australia is I would say, faring relatively well. We're still on the upward trajectory in terms of infections, but I think compared to a lot of the European countries and parts of the United States, we're probably doing pretty well. I'll compare it this way. Australia's probably doing about as well as Washington State. It's doing much better than New York City or New York State is doing. So I think, look, at a comparative point of view, I think Australia is doing quite well.
Dr. Lee, what are maybe some of the lessons that we can apply that you've learned in the Asia Pacific to the United States, which is a couple of months essentially behind what's going on in Asia?
Our generation has never really endured a pandemic. I know you had the SARS virus in 2003, but that was largely confined to China and Northeast Asia. Much of Australians and much of Asia hasn't really experienced anything like this. So when we think about risk, we always thought about political risk, about military risk, about financial risk, economic risk. We never really thought about non-human risk, if you want to put it that way. Now, having said that, the COVID-19 pandemic has spread because of failures in governance, as I mentioned. So that in itself is a human risk. But I think we're now remembering that we are, in a sense, secondary to nature, and that there are risks that are not primarily based on the world of human beings.
So if we look at a couple of the countries which have really struggled with this virus in the Asia Pacific, we could look at China, South Korea, Japan, Singapore. How are there any sort of direct lessons from the way that they handled these sort of initial outbreaks that the United States and other Western countries can consider?
If you look at Japan, South Korea, Singapore, and China when it eventually got its act together. One of the things they did was they were very good at monitoring the movements of infected people. So, for example, in Western countries, I think there's an estimate that if you've been found to be infected, there's a 20 to 30% of those people don't remain in isolation in the way they should. That, yes, they'll stay at home, they'll go out occasionally, etc. In these other Asian societies in Singapore, South Korea, Japan, etc., they actually monitor your movements through your phone, for example, or there are other ways they do it. So the point I'm trying to make is it's a very exhausting trench warfare type of approach, but it's about monitoring the movements of infected people. And that's what they've done much better than populations such as the United States and Australia.
Mm. Last question for you, sir. You talked about the growing, I guess, consciousness within Asia-Pacific business community and maybe even governments about disentangling from China, or at least looking at the relationship more skeptically. What are the other maybe geopolitical fallout from this entire crisis after the thing is over that you might be able to foresee right now?
I think one of the major, perhaps the major geopolitical consequence of this is that it's undoubtedly worsened American-China relations. One, the United States is understandably, in my view, angry about the suppression of information that really led to an epidemic becoming a pandemic. But more than that, even now you're seeing a propaganda war being initiated by the Chinese to try to define a narrative of how well they did compared to how badly the United States and other Western moxies are doing. So that rupture over this particular issue, COVID-19, is going to play out in the pre-existing tensions that had already existed between the United States and China. So eventually the pandemic won't be the top news story. We will return to geopolitics. But the United States-China relationship, I think, will be far more fraught and unfriendly than it was before COVID-19. Now, how that plays out in the rest of the world, other countries won't take the same kind of combative or adversarial position with respect to China because they're too small and they don't have the capabilities of the United States. But at the same time, they will want to diversify not just their economic relationship with China, they'll want to diversify when it comes to their friends and partners in strategic terms across the region and the world. So I think COVID-19 in the medium long term will be a major problem for Beijing.
Dr. Li, you've mentioned diversification away from China on the business level a couple times here. What does that look like on the ground, right? So if you're a country such as Vietnam, who's sort of had this long-standing economic relationship, what does a post-coronavirus world look like?
Diversification economic terms for much of Southeast Asia and East Asia means that that parts and components which currently majority of which come from China, they will not want to be reliant on the Chinese economy to continue their normal economic activity. So for example, if you're a company in Vietnam producing parts for the car industry, currently around 90% of your parts come from China. I think it's become apparent that that is an intolerable risk and they will seek to find other suppliers in Asia and in other parts of the world. Now, this conversation for the first time really is taking place at a wide level throughout the whole Asia-Pacific region to an extent that I haven't seen before. And it's still the very early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. That will continue. It makes good business sense. They may not necessarily be interested in the strategic implications of that, but it makes good business sense. Now, in terms of what that means from the strategic point of view, these countries, as they reduce their reliance on China, that gives them a bit more freedom maneuver. That doesn't mean they'll suddenly become partners and allies of the United States, but it does mean that they have more defenses against the economic coercion that they often feel from China when they're making decisions. Overall, I think that's a good thing. The United States obviously has a role to play in that, but I don't think it's just the United States. I think other advanced economies like Japan and South Korea have quite an important role. And I hope the EU as well steps in and becomes a far more important economic partner. So it's about lowering your economic reliance on China. And once you do that, you have more strategic and political freedom of maneuver with respect to China.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, sir. We really appreciate your time.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode.
So we're still going to be doing all of our episodes remotely, and I hope you can bear with us through that process, because the next couple of weeks are going to be really interesting, and we're going to be talking about coronavirus in all aspects, in terms of our economy, in terms of our geopolitics, as you just heard, and as the news progresses, we're going to be bringing you whatever we possibly can in order to make you help put into context one of the most momentous events, certainly, of our lifetime. So make sure you stay tuned to The Realignment.
And as always, please rate, like, subscribe to The Realignment wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you have any friends who are looking for good content during this quarantine process, we have 29 other episodes to listen to. We'd love to hear them. Check us out. See you next week.